Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R., a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, and unfortunately my co-host, Delilah Jones, this evening is away from us. She unfortunately has the flu pretty badly. Either that or she's knitting my birthday sweater, but I really do think that she is ill, so I am flying solo here. And so looking forward to our evening's guest, because this is a gentleman, a very learned gentleman, and one who I met personally, I believe in September, when I was at the National Organization for Victim Assistance Conference in Ohio. And we have the pleasure of featuring this evening Dr. Will Marling, who is the executive director of NOVA. And just to give you a little bit of background before we start, Will is a native of Ohio who earned his graduate and postgraduate degrees with a bent towards spiritual and anthropological and cultural orientations. He came to the National Organization for Victim Assistance as the executive director in July of 2007, and he has been working in the field in many capacities, but in particular, a specialty is that he is a certified identity theft risk management specialist and the primary spokesperson for NOVA. And I have to tell you that, you know, NOVA has been around for many, many years, and I think we'll probably get into that a little bit, but because perhaps many of our audience members are not familiar with it unless they happen to have been introduced to an advocate or whatnot. So without further ado, Will, thank you so much for being with us on Shattered Lives. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you, Donna. It's really a pleasure to join you and your audience.
Well, it's our pleasure, believe me, and we love to have the diversity in our guests, and we love to learn, and that's what the show is about, and the mission being talking about the aftermath of crime, and I think that is part of the mission and the history of NOVA. And if you wouldn't mind, just to give kind of a thumbnail sketch to people with regard to what your mission and history has been.
Well, I'd be happy to. NOVA, the National Organization for Victim Assistance, is really the oldest, longest-standing victim assistance organization of its kind in the nation. And my European colleagues, they have told me they believe it's really the oldest one of its kind in the world. Basically, in 1975, out of a movement that was a coalescence of like the civil rights movement and the law enforcement movement and some other movements, this movement also mm-hmm. emerged, and it began focusing on victims' rights. The fact that historically, at least in our country, victims don't technically have rights under the rule of law. It's the state versus the perpetrator. And so NOVA emerged and then institutionalized, so to speak, out of that movement to focus on victims' rights, victim services, and we also focus on training in those sectors along with crisis intervention, which is also known as like trauma mitigation and education. And we mm-hmm. also have a toll-free victim assistance line, 800-TRI-NOVA. So that's kind of the thumbnail sketch for you.
Okay. And with that kind of a backdrop, I know that I was introduced to it when my dad was killed in a homicide in 1981. It was still very early on in its infancy. And if you had to kind of make a retrospective statement with respect to what it was like then and what it's like now. How would you address how far NOVA has come with respect to accomplishing its goals since the 70s? What can you say with regard to that?
Well, you know, it was in the 70s when the first three victim assistance units emerged out of prosecutors' offices. So it was the early 70s. And even, I think, California had the first state victim compensation program around that time. And
right.
Today, just by comparison, today we have victim advocates all over the country in many jurisdictions. Every state has a state compensation program. Now, there's a lot of time and a lot of history between those two points. I want to say that, of course, we've made tremendous progress in the movement and so much good work has been done. But then again, every day a new victim is born, and the experience of that person is singularly important to that person and that person's family or the surviving members of that person's family. So I'm always careful because we always want to celebrate progress, but we always recognize the risks for secondary victimization and traumatization that could happen even today when folks who should have a dignified response in the justice process and dignified investigations and treatment and report taking and service, if that's not their experience, they could easily say, wow, well, what's this progress you're telling me about that, you know, mine has not been. But I would affirm that, you know, today, in this decade, our emphasis really is upon the growing professionalism of the victim advocacy and the crisis response movement, though we still want to make progress and growth in other areas, including victims' rights as policy and law, and that enforcement of those rights. We also know that the professionalism is important.
Well, yes, and I think that is the appropriate thrust. And in the materials that I've been reading, isn't prevention of re-victimization also another main focus of NOVA these days?
Well, yes, prevention at that level of re-victimization, re-traumatization is always a commitment that we have. And how do you do that? Well, you do that by training people in appropriate, professional, competent, capable, and volunteer-capable service so that when they go in to serve somebody who's gone through something horrific, they speak the appropriate language, they provide the right services, and they have a competent, compassionate, and committed attitude towards serving. So indeed, we're very committed to that. And we know it comes from training primarily because people need an orientation about struggles and the needs that victims have in the aftermath of crime.
Can you give us a scenario in which how are people charged with doing their duty if they are certified with NOVA? Is it similar to if you have an incident with the police and you call in your crisis response team and your forensic people? Say, for example, you know, there is a new event and you get a phone call. What happens from there, Will?
Okay. Well, let's look at that from two different perspectives. One is that on our victim advocacy side, we are part of this larger network of victim advocates specifically, and those advocates can be based in police departments, prosecutors' offices. They can be based in shelters, domestic violence centers, and they're all over the country, and we're part of that. We consider ourselves kind of a node in that network, but we certainly don't own that. We're part of supporting that, and of course today, after all these years, many states have their own victim assistance academies to train, for instance. But in the aftermath of an event, many times a high-profile event or a significantly mass casualty event, and by that it means mass casualty becomes really two or more people, but the mass casualty in a community or context is when the demands of what's happened exceed what's available locally. And so we have been deploying crisis response teams since 1986, and we might get a request at our national office But today, after training tens of thousands of people, many times those responses are handled at a state and local level. So if there's an incident, those people responding to that incident would be local. Now, if they ask for reinforcements because, you know, the situation is profoundly demanding for scale, then we could send in teams. And also occasionally, we do deploy highly specialized tactical teams from our headquarters of folks we've trained around the country, because the nature of that incident is so significantly demanding. In other words, it demands special skills, or the profile is intensely high. There's a lot of scrutiny, a lot of need, and maybe as well there's no crisis response team available. Maybe it's in a rural community or area, but nonetheless, you know, the nation knows about it. And so that's for us how we might respond in a particularly a mass casualty situation.
Uh-huh. So you feel like, and often the crime victims that we see in our organization that we work with too, many times they're not in a big city or near a medical examiner's office or the police typically may not have the appropriate training. So is that where you see that NOVA can kind of go in and fill in the gaps?
Well, we certainly try. We have a toll-free victim assistance line, as I mentioned. And, of course, we're not in a position to assume a role that local law enforcement should and would take in terms of investigation and the like. But many times we'll get a call. We kind of get two kind of general categories of call that range around the full spectrum of victimization. One call is somebody was assaulted last night, let's say. They ended up in the hospital. The hospital gave them a brochure, and our number's at the top of that list. So they start down, you know, the list, and they call us. And so the easy connection there is, okay, we need to connect you to your local victim assistance provider, your local victim services. So we find out where they are, and we make sure they have that number, because that's most likely the best resource for them immediately, that local victim assistance program in their county. Then we could get cases that have been going on for some time, and for a lot of different reasons, those folks haven't felt like they've had some satisfaction. We get a lot of stalking, harassment, identity theft calls in this category, for instance. And, you know, when these instances can go on for sometimes years, when people don't know what to do, they've not been able to resolve this, law enforcement, of course, can't necessarily dedicate resources to helping them track a person and deal with that. And so we will talk about safety planning. We'll talk through some checklists. We'll try to equip them with important information to help them deal with those things and remediate, if possible, like with identity theft, or to guide them in stalking and harassment and the appropriate strategies for dealing with that.
Well, that's very interesting to me, because I guess I wouldn't think, in having had all this experience over 30 years, that would necessarily be, that NOVA would be somebody to call on for that. But I think that is a wonderful option, and I'm glad that you've kind of developed that as a niche market, per se, because I think it is very needed with all of the social media and, you know, cyber crime and whatnot. So I definitely think that's wonderful. And just in terms of structurally, can you just differentiate for me, and I'm not sure if our listeners know, there is another organization out there nationally that was founded by the Von Bülow family called the National Center for Victims of Crime. Can you differentiate how NOVA may differ from that entity versus you?
Well, yeah, the National Center for Victims of Crime is another great organization, as you said, that came out of the Sonny Von Bülow context. And, well, we have a lot of similarities in many ways. It's certainly a wonderful fraternal relationship that we have with them, and certainly I celebrate that. They're tremendously strong, specifically in policy, as I would say it. It's not that we don't commit to that, because we do. We're working to address this issue of the gap in the United States Constitution, believe it or not, the gap in actually victims' rights in the Constitution, rights for crime victims in the Constitution. We can talk about that if you like, but For your question, the National Center for Victims of Crime is really strong in addressing policy issues. They're also based in Washington, D.C. We're just outside of the district in Northern Virginia, and we have a good relationship there. And they tend to have professional constituencies that they draw and connect with as a network as well. And so, it's a great collaboration that we have, where they tend to touch different sectors of this market, so to speak, and we do differently. They're great professionals, and they have a great conference as well.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that it is a collaborative versus adversarial relationship, because it certainly, it certainly wouldn't work any other way, and it, would kind of just defame the whole mission of what you're supposed to be doing. So I'm very glad to hear that, and I'm glad that you differentiated for me and our listeners. But why don't we talk about, one of the main thrusts that you've been trying to do in terms of getting a constitutional amendment for crime victim rights? It is very important, and we need to tell people about that, what you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. Let me give it just a little bit of background. History is helpful here. And it's helpful to understand, the big picture, of course, as we've talked, but it's also to help people understand why this is so important. Because when you start talking about amending the Constitution, that's big. And naturally, people are they are automatically resistant just for the sake of that, because our founding document is so important, and you just don't change it every day. But this is an important issue that the movement has been considering for many years. I'll just give a tiny little bit of historic background here. 150 years ago, really, it's much longer, but 150 years ago, the emphasis in our society, and even back with the revolution and moving forward in this country, the emphasis on crime and criminals and victimization was, it became, and I won't go into all that history, but it became really a debt-to-society philosophy. And that really was a shift for human history. You can go back into Babylonian history 4,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, and discover texts that talk about victims' rights. But without, I'll have to evaporate all that for the sake of time here, but really at the beginning of our nation, the focus became a debt-to-society philosophy about victimization. And what that did was it really moved victims out of the framework of loss that they experience at the hands of criminals. There was historically, before that, a commitment to restitution and the like. A criminal who violates somebody is responsible to repay that, if possible, one way or another, to pay the debt to the person. And so we've been dealing with the impact of this debt-to-society philosophy, whereby we have prisons to pay your debt to society. And you'll hear this. People talk about this because they don't know any different. Well, in the 70s, when this came to fruition, this notion of, wait a minute, who is harmed most by this? It's not society. Society is harmed. Communities are harmed by crime, no question about it. But at the heart of that, at the front line of that, are people, individuals, adults, children, the young, the old, any race, any creed. And the focus began to say, no, wait a minute, what about these people? And it was at that time, during the early 80s, when a focus even at a federal level became, we need to ask some of these questions. In fact, when President Reagan was shot, he discovered the justice system's reaction to him, even as President of the United States. And some other things that emerged, Donna, was ultimately President Reagan established a panel. He set up this really kind of this working group, so to speak, that traveled around the country, took statements, gathered data, and produced a report. And it's the President's Commission, really, is what it was, on victims' rights. And the commission ultimately issued 68 recommendations for really improving justice on behalf of the system, but on behalf of those victims. And the 68th recommendation was that ultimately, in the United States Constitution, victims need rights. Now, people are surprised.
That was the 68th out of all of them? That was like the bottom?
That was,
are,
what
are
was
we going
the bottom?
From top down? Like we're working on 1, 2, 3, 4, and then?
Reverse it, Donna. Then, reverse it, actually. Reverse it, because it was really going to kind of like, you know, it's the big finale. You know, here's the really big deal. Here are all these things that need to change, but at the bottom line is this, number 68, which is really the biggest and the most profound.
Yeah.
And they said a lot in the report. In this report, they said, you know, all of these things, but here's the thing. You know, number 68, we recommend an amendment to the United States Constitution for victims' rights. And so go ahead. You have a question there.
Well, I'm just saying it wasn't initially – the way it was written, it wasn't based in hierarchy of need then, or was it?
No, not specifically. I mean, the report is well-written, but it didn't start with that because there were so many meaningful, simpler changes that could be made.
Right.
And so that's what they emphasized, these things, many of which actually were implemented. And from the report, ultimately – Congress set up the Office for Victims of Crime, which is a federal office, and the charge specifically was to pursue the implementation of these 68 recommendations. Well, that was 84 when the Victims of Crime Act was established. And so since that time, we've been trying to remind people, remind legislators and, you know, our federal representatives that there is a gap there in the United States Constitution as we see it. Now, if I could just contextualize this a bit, if you're victimized by a crime, by a criminal, and the accused then is arrested, you know, an officer would likely read that person his rights to start. And, you know, many people, my kids know what Miranda is. You have the right to remain silent. If you give up the right to remain silent, on and on and on. Well, turn around and ask yourself, what rights are read to the victim of that very same crime? And, you know, it's crickets, right? There's nothing to say because there aren't any. And as well,
they're supposed to pull out that card, aren't they, the police, from, you know, and these are your rights as a crime victim. And here's where you can get help.
Well, first of all, there are no federal rights as a crime victim.
Federal,
second of all,
that's
right. Second of all, it might depend on the state because, yes, 33 states out of the 50 states do have victims' rights in their state constitution. But Miranda rights really represent a federal commitment. That was a United States Supreme Court ruling. And in the United States Constitution, under the Bill of Rights, you know, the first 10 amendments to the United States Constitution, the accused have upwards of 23 protections that they might use to protect themselves from the power and authority of the state overextending itself. And, of course, our founders were very, very creative and innovative in affirming that. But here's the thing. With all of those rights, which we affirm. I mean, those shouldn't be changed. Those shouldn't be moved or removed. At the same time, there are no rights to help the victim, and the responsibility of the state to treat that victim with dignity, with compassion, with the right to information, the right to even future safety considerations. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
So that's why we contend that that should happen.
How close are we to achieving that? I'm sorry.
Well, that's always the question because the process for amendments, according to the fifth, you know, article is of the Constitution, you can amend the Constitution by either the states deciding that they want to ratify, change the Constitution, and then it comes to Congress, so you can go the other way. So we right now are working with Congress on the House side specifically. House Joint Resolution 40 was introduced into the House of Representatives. And that represents a proposed amendment for crime victims' rights. And so right now we're working to educate House leaders or House members specifically on this issue and the value of this. And, of course, you know, in any average two-year session of Congress, there's between 10 and 12,000 bills that are introduced. Between 2 and 4% of them pass. And, of course, it's a tiny, tiny percentage less that ultimately are joint resolutions, because that's where amendments come from, the House Joint Resolution. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we're making progress. It's quiet and in some ways invisible because we're educating members of Congress, but we are working at it, believe me, and very, very hard.
Well, I know that when we were at the conference in Ohio, we had the opportunity to be able to sign, you know, a petition and whatnot. But if people feel strongly about this and want to add their voice what would be your advice with regard to that?
Well, there is a website where people can go and affirm their support for this, and it's mm-hmm. called NVCAP. The letters, nvcap.org.
nvcap.org.
Yeah. nvcap.org. And you can go there and you can see information about the amendment. You can read the proposed amendment and so on. And then you can also sign a petition supporting it. What
right.
I would say to as well, right now, we're working to educate members of Congress. Here's the thing. As I mentioned, thousands of bills. You know, you'd think this was a slam dunk because, wow, victims' rights, so obvious, so needy. Everybody would sign on this. You know, you walk out on the street, victims have rights, and they would say, well, of course they do. But they don't realize that under the Constitution they don't. And suddenly they're all outraged, mm-hmm. you know, let's do this. And at the same time, there's a lot of distractions in Congress. As you know, Congress is having its own troubles kind of understanding how to communicate with one another, and you know, there are plenty of challenges.
It's a myriad of issues, right? So hopefully it doesn't, you know, our mission is always to try to get it to rise to the top and to get them to work collaboratively. I mean, we can in our own nonprofit organizations and for our own mission, but to transfer, you know, that kind of ethic to Congress, it just seems like they can't get anything accomplished. So, but we can't give up, even though we know that that's, you know, they're at a stalemate with regard to Obamacare and all of those kinds of issues, but I think we still have to keep trying, correct?
Well, we do, and it's about two things. I would acknowledge in, if I may say humbly, because I would not consider myself an expert, even in living in the environs of Washington, D.C. I'm not an
uh-huh.
insider, I'll tell you that. I have to call myself an enthusiast at this point, but I've tried to become a student of these processes, and what I would gently suggest and humbly suggest is that, first of all, we need to be doing our work, and that is we need to be educating our representatives. So if any of your listeners
right.
want to contact their representative and say, hey, you know, would you consider co-sponsoring House Joint Resolution 40? That's a positive thing.
Right.
If they're willing to do that, because that phone call specifically, don't send a letter, just get on the phone and call them, either at their local constituent office or in Washington, D.C., and say, hey, I'm interested in House Joint Resolution 40. Are you? That's a good thing to do. And the second thing is that – go ahead.
No, I was just going to agree with you. I think that is a very – that's a very proactive stance, because here they're in your community, they want to do something meaningful, they want to get reelected, and especially if you are a crime victim, you can bring your personal story to your person from Congress, and that will lend more credibility to what you're asking, correct?
Well, it does. I mean, crime victims certainly have a powerful place and a powerful voice, especially when they're talking to their legislator. But we also have to recognize in the process of this, and this is one of the things I've learned, that when you talk about changing the Constitution, you're not just talking about helping crime victims at present. You're talking about an emphasis on safety and security for our posterity. That is to say, I've got teenage kids, and I don't want them to have to experience the justice system that, unfortunately, I've had to see people experience in my work. I want them, first of all, not to go through the justice system. I want them not to have experienced criminal victimization. And the way that starts is a society that recognizes dignity and compassion in other people and says, you know, I need to honor fellow man and women. But we know that people don't do that. I mean, that's, you know, crime is with us. It's here to stay. But for the future, whenever people are empowered as victims of something, that works, you know, meaningful change in a society. And it emboldens those people who have been victimized and vulnerable to stand up. And that collaborative voice tells the people who would perpetrate, at the very least, they are being heard. We need to pay attention to that. Now, they might still go ahead and, in a narcissistic commitment to hurt, do it all the same. But for those who might be on the edge and saying, well, you know, maybe, wait a minute, the person I thought was vulnerable isn't quite as vulnerable, and there's a cloud of witnesses who are standing with this person. I believe that our society's emphasis on that could be strong and powerful for our nation, to bring us not only together, but to affirm our commitment to safety, security, and in a way that actually reflects a respect for what the founders invested in the Bill of Rights in the first place.
I definitely agree, and I think there is definitely power in numbers, and particularly that kind of segues me into the next area that I wanted to talk to you about. You know, with the with so many mass shootings taking place over the last couple of years, and particularly in my home state of Connecticut, we've been bombarded by numerous tragedies here, and our resilience, I just don't know. But with respect to that, where mass shootings are, I hate to say it this way, almost becoming commonplace these days, what do you see, you see the landscape changing with regard to how Nova might approach this and what we do? And my concern, Will, is that will the general public over a period of time take these issues, will they take them more seriously, or will they fall into a complacency, you know, after a period of time, or, you know, does it take another tragedy for us to say no more? I mean, what are we going to do about these kinds of things, like a Sandy Hook, like an Aurora, those kinds of things, Will?
Well, you know, that's obviously a great and important question. I kind of contextualize it this way. All of these things are horrible. The violence that's perpetrated at this scale, as well as smaller scales, should be unacceptable to us. But to contextualize this further, the worst elementary school disaster, violence, was actually in 1927, where a man killed 38 elementary school children and 6 adults. And I doubt that anybody much has ever heard of the Bath School disaster. And, you know, why is that?
You got me on that one, too. Yeah, tell us a little bit.
Well, you know, I'm in no way minimizing the tragedies that have occurred in the past years, or decades. I mean, no, that's not my comparison here at all. But what I am trying to affirm is that we've been dealing with these kinds of violent victimizations for as long as there's been humanity. And yet, the question is, are there differences? Are there changes? Are there dynamics whereby, you know, are we going to ever stop crime? No, of course not. But are there ways to stop certain kinds of crime in certain contexts? And I would affirm, absolutely. And sometimes I try to encourage people a little bit by saying, you know, the Sandy Hook tragedy was, you know, we're coming up on their anniversary, December 12th, 2012.
Next Saturday, as a matter of fact. The 14th,
December 14th, 2012. And horrible, horrible. You know, I've been to Newtown, and it's just absolutely dreadful. And yet I know, too, just because of the work I do, there have been many different things avoided because of citizens who care about things that are going on, they're paying attention, law enforcement who's done investigations on potential threats and threats and these kinds of things. So I try to encourage, you know, some reflection to say, well, we don't know all of the tragedies that have been diverted in our society and our communities by people actually being alerted, not wanting these things to happen, paying attention to people around them, paying attention to threats, law enforcement taking those things seriously. And we can't capture all of that. I know of one incident in Virginia specifically where a young man went into a gun store and the owner refused to sell to him. And so the gentleman, went and he used, a bow and a knife, and he was able to injure students when he did a school. But nobody knew about it. You didn't probably hear about it because it didn't rise to the level of sometimes what the media wants to portray. And I'm not minimizing, again, the violence that was portrayed, but the impact was not there because, the gun shop owner refused to sell to him. So, you're not going to hear a big hurrah from people, about that because bad things happen, but you also have to factor in, wait a minute, some people did make choices. Now, in dealing with future incidents, we're always trying to be ready. We're always trying to – we have people prepared. We don't send in any teams without a formal and written invitation, and we've pretty much been on most sites and most high profile incidents one way or another, but we never just go in. There's the problem of people who self deploy, and they just show up and say I'm here to help you, and quite candidly, that causes a lot of problems typically. And so
do have to be formally invited then.
Protocol requires that we're officially invited by somebody in authority, not just somebody, but somebody in authority, because if we show up, we want to have the credentials to be able to respond at their request that they've asked us to
do. Who would be that authority, Will? Would it be the governor, the police chief? Who would be that person to request you?
Yeah, it could be any of those folks. It depends on who's inviting us, for instance. For instance, if we were asked to go into a school specifically, it could be the principal or the superintendent of the school. But, for instance, after 9/11, the governor of New Jersey was one site that we responded to. The governor of New Jersey invited us in to provide service at their family assistance center. So it all depends on where and who is inviting and the level of authority that is required to make sure that we have the access we need to do the job we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does. One thing in remembering, I had such a very rewarding experience at NOVA this last time and networked with so many different people, and in fact, it's going to be helping me in the future for sure. But one thing that really struck me was that you had a lot of participants from the military. And, in fact, being there dressed in their fatigues every day, so you saw exactly who they were. And we're just now coming to become aware of the epidemic proportion of, we've always been aware that domestic violence, or like we like to term intimate partner violence or homicide, is at epidemic proportions. But with regard to this epidemic or this problem within the military, whether it pertains to that or sexual assault, it's just kind of rampant and has been sort of, we're just revealing it. It's been behind closed doors because of whatever protocols or people being afraid of them losing their jobs if they were, or to indicate those kinds of things. I just was very, very impressed with that and the fact that they really want to make a proactive stance to do things to be able to stem the tide of this. So I wondered if you would kind of address that area.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. We have been working with the military to support an effort that's called the Department of Defense Sexual Assault Advocate Certification Program. NOVA is the certification secretariat for DSACP, as it's called. You gotta love military acronyms. And basically, we certify the sexual assault advocates through this program. On our civilian side, we've had, for nearly 10 years, we've had the National Advocate Credentialing Program, and that really became the foundation for, as I said, DSACP. What I would suggest is that while there is much work to be done, I obviously don't speak for the military, even in our work with the military, but I would suggest that we've truly made progress and the military is committed to making progress, and some might contend against me. I would say there's meaningful evidence to suggest that progress is being made there, including the commitment to appropriate standards for training those advocates and certifying them. I mean, that's a big step for the military, as well as even the open discussion about it. And that's difficult. You know, when you start talking about these very difficult issues, it's hard, because it's not that people don't want to talk about it, but, you know, you kind of still don't. You look at the military and you think about it as a, you know, defending our country and the honor and the nobility of that commitment. And most people in the military do have that. But, Jen, if you have anybody who is, not up to that standard and perpetrates, they have a unique opportunity to do that, because soldiers live and work in the same place. If you go to work in the civilian sector, most of the time you go to work, let's say, 9 to 5 or whatever, then you're going to go home. At least you're going to be able to get out of that. Or you can change jobs, but you can't change jobs if you're the victim of, say, sexual assault in the military. So it does create some unique situations and unique challenges, no question. But we have seen tremendous progress, and I would say that the department that we work with is just profoundly committed to this. We work with Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office out of the Pentagon, and they are, I've seen nothing but a commitment to confront this issue and support our efforts to raise the standards high for victim advocates.
Well, we're glad to hear that, and we hope in the future to try to piggyback upon that, because our former colleague who tragically passed away of cancer, Susan Murphy Milano, had the document, the evidentiary abuse affidavit, that has just been a wonderful, wonderful prevention tool, and she saved thousands of lives. So I'm hoping that we can still connect with those military people, and I have not still yet heard from them, but perhaps maybe with a little nudge from powers that be, we can connect. Will, I'm hoping, mm-hmm. I'm hoping that very seriously. So I want to say that for the record and on the air, that we'd like to work with those people if we could somehow connect together. If you have the occasion to talk to them again in the near future, we would really, really appreciate that.
Sure enough.
Great. I really would, Russell and some of those other people, because I have not heard back from them since the conference. Another area that I know that you are certified in, and it's a very important topic, and we have about 16 minutes or so left of our show at this point, is cybercrime. And I would love to talk about that with respect to how prolific is this as an issue. What kinds of things are being done, and what do you see the future with these other things that can be done with respect to this area? Because it just seems to be the information age will never slow down. It's just ever exploding and pervasive in our lives.
Yeah, well, the first thing I want to say is I don't think I've ever been on a radio interview, or even a television interview for that matter, that has had such diversity of topics by such a wonderful host as you. So this is really great. It's enriching to be able to have a meaningful conversation, to take the time to talk through issues rather than, really, can you summarize the problems we face in our world in a 30-second soundbite? That really gets frustrating sometimes. But I appreciate the diversity we've had.
You've made my day, Will. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
I'm honored that you said that.
Well, this is a lot like us sitting chatting, as we've done before. So, I feel really comfortable, too, which is nice. I would suggest that the issue of the cyber is an issue, if not in a sense the issue, and I'm not, again, minimizing other forms of victimization. What I would say is the cyber has become a tool to use as a weapon in many sectors. So not only do we see the cyber as a violation of data, for instance, data breaches or identity theft, we're seeing the cyber used to victimize in many ways. Now we talk about cyberbullying. We see how stalking uses the cyber as a tool. We see even in domestic violence situations where, say, a woman is being victimized by her abuser, and the cyber, through identity theft or the electronic stalking, has become yet another tool. So I would suggest that it is a singularly large issue, primarily because the cyber, of course, is so pervasive. I'm careful because, again, I don't want to terrify everybody to the point that, number one, they think they can, you know, they just bury their heads in the sand and say, well, I can't confront this. It's just too overwhelming. That's really not helpful. And the other is to really think that, well, I'm not on the Internet. I got rid of my cell phone. I'm not going to be vulnerable, because, candidly, all of our information is out there somewhere. We've given it appropriately to somebody, our doctor, our lawyer, our school, and so we have to pay attention. I would suggest that it is a big problem, that then there at the same time, we read about things every day, there are things we can do. And a lot of these things revolve, in a sense, around paying more meaningful attention, believe it or not. And, you know, mm-hmm. you wouldn't think that the case, but, for instance, we're trying to emphasize remediation, and that's where people are victimized in this. And so people will call us on a victim assistance line, and we'll talk through, okay, how do we resolve this? And we get calls of all kinds. You know, somebody who's taken over their Facebook account, somebody who is posting bad information about them, somebody who has actually copied their picture from Facebook and created a fake Facebook account, or they're harassing them, or they've stolen, they've gotten medical services in their name through identity theft, this kind of thing. And all of these mm-hmm. things, the reason it gets so mysterious is there are so many angles, in a sense, for us to be victimized. You know, if you're physically assaulted on the street, that's bad. There's no question that's bad. But it is localized. Somebody did that to you right there. And whether you identify him or not is a different story. And people clearly feel unsafe after that. But many times the cyber, you get attacked and you don't even know where it's coming from. And it might be, you know, your next door neighbor, or it could be, you know, somebody from another country. And so we're emphasizing really some basic principles to protect ourselves. And so we ask questions, or we kind of have principles like this. You know, you are your data. People need to recognize that. You are your data. You can't simply say, I'm not on the Internet, so I'm not out there. And as well, we say, if it has a lock, use it. You know, you might have noticed recently an acknowledgement that 2 million email passwords were stolen. And the review of that information, and this is a common thing. I mean, it happens. It's happening regularly, you know, every
and
day.
And aren't you contracted with SafeLock, Will? I mean, isn't that the company that was there that did a presentation as well?
Well, we have a partnership with a company called LifeLock that's an identity theft protection company.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've had a good long relationship with them, and they work with us to help remediate, but also to assist. And also, they've provided some funding for us to do training and things. And they're a very collaborative company and very supportive. But, you know, it's funny mm-hmm. because you say when these people's email addresses were stolen, when they did the analysis, a lot of their passwords were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And, you know, that's something you could change. Create a more complex password. Who has one key for their car, their house, their office? That's how we think. And we just have to make it tougher. You know, we say if it's convenient for you, it's probably convenient for the perpetrator. So make it a little more complicated. Make things a little more difficult. I know it's easy to default to, you know, easy passwords, but that makes it, you know, you more vulnerable. We also are just encouraging people when they're asked for information, it's appropriate to say, well, what for? Why are you're asking me for this, but, you know, should I have to give it to you? What are you going to do with it? How are you going to store it? And when you start, I think if we started kind of this movement, Donna, right here today on this radio broadcast, if we started challenging people, just it's okay to ask what for, then a lot of the people would start responding, well, I'm not sure, so maybe I don't need to ask that question. I don't need to ask you for that data. I mean, we have cases where I can find on applications for sororities and fraternities where they ask for the sorority applicant's social security number on that application. The question is, Why does a sorority need your social security number? You know, what are they going to do?
And what has the response been?
Well, there is no response because, for instance, for those, I'm just pointing out, that's a training thing for me because I just capture those and show people, what do you think a sorority? No, you can't give me a good reason because technically there is no legal reason for a sorority to ask for that. There's very limited context for the use of the social security number, for instance. So, you know, people don't think, well, okay, I'm supposed to give it, so they give it. I mean, we've had people set up shop on campus, give away movie tickets to college students if they'll just fill out this little form that says name, address, date of birth, social security number, and they're perpetrators. Well, they give out real legitimate movie tickets, but, you know, for a $10 movie ticket, I just have everything I need to commit identity theft against this college student, you see.
That is so scary. That they would be so trusting to say, okay, here's the stuff, I get to go to the movie. Like, which is of more value to you at that point in time?
Right.
And it just shows how, you know, college students' brains are not fully developed, and you need to, you need to think. You really do.
That's
so
right.
I think
it's
you've given us some very practical things to think about, just, you know, in terms of, you know, it's a double-edged sword, I think, Will, in terms of our lives are so multitasking, fast-paced, and we want to simplify, okay, what is the password I can remember? And believe me, I've got, like, 3 full-time jobs here, work for state government, had my website and radio show and, you know, trying to move to another state. So it's like, yeah, I can't remember all those things. I want to simplify, but yet if we make it too simple, everybody can hack in. So, you know, what is the answer here, Will? You know, it's mind-boggling. But I think that, you know, you've given us a lot to think about. With our few remaining minutes, we still have a little time here. Can you talk about what are the benefits of joining NOVA and who should join and what do you get?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and I really appreciate it. It's very kind of you to say that. We, as a membership organization, I'm not going to tout that we have huge membership benefits. We're not like AAA. And if your car breaks down, you know, we're gonna come and change a tire. But what we found is basically our constituency is a group of people who really is making a small investment through that membership to just really support the work that we do. It, you know, the membership does represent a small discount when it comes to attending our national conference or doing some of our trainings. But I don't want to oversell it in terms of, you know, the folks and what they get. Basically, when a person joins NOVA, they become part of our network, and they do get access to communication, which you can set up. But, you know, I'll play my hand that if somebody were to go to our website, they could have a free NOVA One account, which is, it doesn't cost anything, but it's really, you know, they can tell us how they want to be communicated with, if they want to get information. When people make the membership step, it really is like other, you know, meaningful and noble opportunities just to say, you know, I'm making even a small investment here, and I appreciate that. Most of our memberships, they fall into two categories. One is they want the benefit maybe of a discount to go into conference, but most people really do it because they're committed to this work and they're committed to NOVA and, you know, the work we've done for decades now, and they want to support that in a meaningful way.
And they're not doing it for the money, that's for sure.
No, they're not.
No.
You're right.
The human service professions, I mean, I've been in some of them all of my life in various aspects, and it's like, you know, I'll never be rich, but I'm a lot happier in doing the kinds of things that that I have been in, versus being an engineer or a doctor, an IT person or whatever. And, you know, serving other people, it is so rewarding, you know, and I don't know, we have about 5 minutes or so. Can you think of a particular story that is impactful in terms of that really demonstrates the skills of what NOVA has to offer in working with a family? And then we also want to have your contact information for sure in case people do want to get in touch, okay?
Sure. Well, you know, there are a lot of stories that come out of our work, and sometimes I'm careful because, you know, the folks that I know are doing this, they're doing it, and they don't want anybody to know about it, you know, the great work they're doing as such. I will say, you know, as a qualifier, what drew me to lead the organization was when I was investigating this particular network of victim advocates and crisis responders, I realized that it's one of the lowest paid professions in the country, quite frankly. But at the same time, it was one of the highest dedication professions and vocations and even volunteer network, that clearly people were making their commitment to this, to train, to prepare, and to serve in very difficult situations because the mission was in view. And I would say pound for pound, I've never met a vocation that is as dedicated and as committed to training and preparing and to serving as, you know, the wonderful and incredible network I'm part of. And so as I, you know, I think about the stories, there are so many that revolve around that very thing. And I don't want to disclose, you know, I'm careful because people, again, we're talking about victims. We don't ever want to disclose without their permission. But I know of, right. of incredible situations. I know of a situation, for instance, with a lawyer who, you know, flew across many states to go into a courtroom to represent, in particular in California, a victim who had been barred from the court to view the murder trial of her son. And the defense counsel had put them on the witness list, and because of that, the judge felt it was his responsibility then to bar them from proceedings, because that's kind of the process, or historically the process. You know, if you're going to be on the witness list, you can't be in the courtroom until after you've given testimony. And so this attorney flew across country to argue victims' rights under California law, which did exist, as California has today now, Marcy's Law, one of the farthest-reaching victims' rights, you know, protections, and argued before the judge to the point that the judge said, well, I have to let this family in the court. In fact, there's no way I cannot let them in the court under the law. And so, you know, it's moments like that where we realize that the law is there in some sectors. Of course, as I've said, we need it at the highest level, but also we need those advocates, whatever they might be, a legal advocate, a lawyer, or a victim advocate, who's literally with that person in court, helping them understand what they're going through, helping them understand the process, educating them about where this would go, providing resources to them. And that happens every day, Donna, as you know, across this nation. And completely almost invisible, too, as you know. Just, you know, people don't know victim advocates exist until when they become victims, or if they happen to work in the courthouse.
Until they need them. Yes, it's one
That's
of those
right.
invisible positions. And, you know, kudos to Michelle Cruz out there, because she helped us tremendously last spring with the parole hearing. And, I will always be indebted to her.
Yeah, I know
her
Michelle.
Dedication
I know
her,
Michelle.
And her skills. Yeah, so
yeah.
I just have to give her kudos. And for our last parting, what advice would you give in terms of to victims as a parting comment?
I would say seek out an advocate for sure. Always look for an advocate. Ask for an advocate. And also remember that there can be a new normal. It's miserable to start. And we need to change that, but, you know, God willing, we'll do that.
We do. And we'll all work together. So we're going to have to close out very shortly, but Will, please do stay in touch. We're going to have you back, if at all possible, if you're willing. And we will write a showcase blog tomorrow, hopefully do you proud. And everyone, please tune in on the archives. Go to www.donnagore.com and imagine publicity.com, and I'll say good evening. Thank you so much, Will. It's been a pleasure, and I'll speak to you very soon. Good evening, everyone.